Has your fuse box gone haywire? Is your water pressure too weak? Or maybe your boiler needs an upgrade? They don't last forever, you know. Well, the good news is that there's a local hero in Dublin for that. So if a blocked sink is not helping with Wednesday's hump day, take the hassle out of it with localheroes.ie. Our online service connects you with trusted tradespeople in your area, and all work comes with a 12-month guarantee backed by Bord Gáis Energy. Try it out while listening to your podcast. You could get a quote in minutes at localheroes.ie. T&Cs apply. Visit localheroes.ie for full details.
This is the Barry Egan Tapes on News Talk. I'm Barry Egan of the Sunday Independent, and today my guest is Mike Hanrahan. Mike, Merry Christmas and thanks for coming in.
Delighted to be here, Barry.
Mike, Christmas is a very religious time for some people, not all people. When you were like a young child, you were quite, you know, used to go to mass regularly, you know, you were a very religious child. How did that change? Can you tell me the what changed that? How did your faith disintegrate?
There was a few things happened. I was interfered with and started slightly abused by a Franciscan brother when I was about 14 or 14 and a half. And then that had an effect on me. That knocked, shook my confidence in the people that were supposed to be protecting me around me, because I spent a lot of time in the churches. I was a good altar boy.
Your first song when you were 12 about St. Joseph, wasn't it?
I figured St. Joseph wasn't getting a look in, so... they were all talking about Jesus and Mary, so my first song was about St. Joseph, the underdog. But I think around when that happened to me, that was a kind of, it shook my confidence, definitely. And then I realised things weren't what they always were saying they were, because I had no idea what was going on in my life. And
Did your mother notice, your father notice a change in you?
No, because I'd kind of discovered Leonard Cohen around the same time. There was a lot of things happening in my life. I was reading different types of books. I was losing interest in school. And it wasn't because of that. It was just me getting more into myself as a writer. I was reading. I was writing poetry. I was doing all sorts of things that none of the rest of the family were doing. So,
when you look back in the poetry you wrote, can you see what that young child had gone through in the poems that you wrote?
Only glimpses of them, and I still have them all. I have everything I've ever written from that period.
Glimpses
glimpses of me, the shaking of
your faith.
Yeah, complete shaking of the faith. And there are glimpses of that even through my diaries. There are glimpses of it, and I guess the only way I dealt with it at the time, Barry, was to try and forget about it and bury it. And that's really what happened. Because
is that like burying a bomb? Eventually, it'll go off.
Yeah, and it eventually did go off.
When did it go off?
It went off on two occasions. It kind of semi went off in 98, 99 when the stories were coming through of the amount of abuse that was happening in the country nationwide. And then the stories broke about America. And then there was a bishop I knew who was involved in some of those scandals, horrible scandals in America. I knew him. And that kind of shook her completely for me, because I had a lot of faith in him as a person. And that's when I started to write about it. So I wrote my first song about it, called The Garden of Roses.
Can you give me a line of that?
I can give you all of them if you want. It's in the garden of roses where you can buy beautiful roses, the eyes of a child. In your secret desire, you cut it all down. And now the petals are scattered on tainted ground. So the roses were the beautiful children, and the ground, this religious figure had come in and just rampaged through the garden of beautiful roses, and the petals were scattered. And I used the word, the ground then was tainted. The ground was so good that it was feeding all these beautiful flowers, was now tainted. But I always kind of try and find hope in everything that I write about. And the second verse is I say about a river once frozen, now deep in the mind, flows on like a river should in the eyes of a child. And that to me was when all the victims of abuse were telling their stories, it was like a freeing of themselves. Their pain had been frozen for so long, and now it was being...
What age were you when you wrote that song?
I was in my 30s, late 30s.
And were you 12 or 13 when the incident happened?
Or 14, yeah.
Yeah. And was it when you were about 21 walking along Middle Abbey Street, which is just up the road from here, you actually saw the priest or the Franciscan brother walk along?
Yeah.
And you stood into a doorway?
That's right, yeah. You have a good memory of reading my book. It was scary because it shook me in a sense that when you bury something, you just kind of forget about it.
Were you back to being a 12-year-old again?
I was back to being really scared. Really, that's what I was. Whether I was 12 or 13, but I was back to being scared, and I was raw. And then that shame comes back. So all that stuff comes back up into you when you're kind of...
Did you blame yourself for it?
Oh, for years, yeah. Of course you do. Because you carry shame, you know. And you live that shame that somehow it was your fault that this happened. And you don't want to talk about it. So the more you bury something inside you, the less you want to talk about it, and the bigger that becomes when it eventually comes up and rears its ugly head. So it was inevitable at some stage in my life I had to deal with it.
And you saw... It was very physical. You saw the dandruff on his...
I'll never forget it, yeah.
On his shoulder as he passed by.
And that's the one thing I remembered about when in the hall, when he was like fondling me and not being very kind to me. And the one thing I remember that time was the dandruff. And it was there again as he walked by behind Abbey Street. I'll never forget it. It was like shudder time. But I dealt with it. And
how did you deal with it?
I went to therapy. When I was 40, but 2005, I was, Jesus, what was I? I was, yeah, nearly 40, for the mid 40s. And I went to therapy for, generally, my life, there was other things in my life. My business was tough. Ronnie Drew had died, or was about to die. My whole life had come to a kind of crossroads.
Did you share your secret with Ronnie?
Yes.
And what did he say to you?
I'd say that'd be, well, I wouldn't like to say what he said to me, except that he just offered me real support, but he was quite angry about it.
Yeah.
And that was between two friends. Ronnie was one of my best mates, so we shared a lot of stories together. And he acted like any friend would have done, I think. He was one of the few people I ever told in my life up to that point. In those years, I didn't tell my mum until... The album was being released in 2002.
What age were you then?
Oh, geez, 44.
So it happened at 12 and you had to wait 30 years.
You bury it.
Yeah.
Bury.
What did your mother, what did she say? Did she cry?
She was shocked and she was crying. Yeah, it was a very, very emotional moment between the two of us. Very emotional. But we kind of, as I said in the book, we crossed the threshold on that moment. She understood more about me, and I certainly understood more about her, because I never blamed, like, my mum was a very religious person, still is. They're dedicated to their church, and I really respect all those people who are really dedicated to it. I am not. I'm at the very furthest end from my mum is, but I have so much respect for her beliefs and her faith. Sometimes I envy people with that amount of faith in something like a Catholic church. But I don't have it.
But given you were so religious as a young boy, there's no way of getting back to that, is there?
I don't think for me, no. Definitely not a chance, no. No, I think there's too much... there was too much hurt from me, not just for me, but for people around me, and hurt for innocent people who believed in this great establishment. And then you see various characters who were church leaders, and you see how they behaved over the years, and you see them on old clips of... I remember when poor Gabe Byrne died, they showed old clips of the old priest who used to go and visit him and before all their scandals came. So those kind of things reinforce your thing that it's not for me, and it's not... And I'm quite happy not to have it. My idea of... eternity is actually here. This life is my eternity, and that's about as long as it is. And while I'm here, I make this eternity as best I can. That's really all I want to do.
Yeah. And when you dealt with it, did your wife realise it, a kind of a lifting of a weight off your shoulders? I mean, had you...
I guess I can't answer that. I don't know, except that I know that my after I went for therapy, I went to arts therapy. I knew I had to kind of figure out a few things in my life, and it wasn't just the church thing at all. That was part of it. My dad had died in 2000, and that was had a profound effect on me. I'd never dealt with that. I never dealt with his loss. And then there was Ronnie, who was imminent death, was a tough time for me. And then there was, I'd come out of the IMRO. I was chairman of IMRO. And that was a high power thing. And I resigned, like in disgust, at something that happened in the company. So all this is like the perfect storm in my life. And it felt like I finally needed to talk to somebody. I'd reached the point when I thought, you need to talk, otherwise it's going to get really, really difficult. So,
what were you like before you talked? Were you very?
I was wired,
very, very sensitive, extremely intense.
I was wired to the moon. I mean, I was work. It was, I buried myself into loads
into
of work.
Into work.
That's it. Yeah.
It was like a concrete up to your neck.
I had. There wasn't enough hours in my day, and
because you didn't want to have time to think.
Yeah, I didn't want to deal with anything, you know. And even though I'd written about Dad in songs, and I that album I released, What You Know, was dedicated to him, but I still hadn't dealt with it. That was
Did you ever tell him?
No, I never got a chance to talk to him about it. No, he was very sick.
Did you, like, he was a very religious man? He would have been horrified at what?
I think he would have been. Yeah,
his faith.
I don't think so. I know he would have been. He would have been, and he would have been. He would have been.
You were trying to protect him.
You know, I can't explain it, but you don't talk about it. You know, you just you really bury it, and it's on that moment when you eventually when all those things were happening in Ireland, that kind of it's like someone shaking, you know, shaking the dust around you, you know, and you're still saying, "Oh, I'll keep going. I'm grand." But, like, you're choking with the dust. It's everywhere. The whole room, then the room is, but you're not going to say anything. Then suddenly something happens and you say, I got to deal with this now. And I dealt with it first by writing about it. But I didn't really deal with it all until 2006 when Dad was long gone. And I went to a friend of mine and says, I need to go for therapy. And he says, I said, I want to do something different. And he said, well... He was a music therapist, and he said, music is no good because you're too clued into music. Have you ever done any art at school? And I said, no. So he said, art is your one. So go to art. So he set up an art therapist for me, and I'd never made anything. I'd never drawn anything. And I drew out my life, and I made my life.
What were the pictures like?
There was a constant, it was amazing. There was a constant drawing of a tree with lights in it. And it was like me trying to cling to that tree. It was always in the distance, and that's where I was trying to find my way to. And I got a kind of mortar or clay one day, and I started just messing with it, and suddenly I made a boat. So it was me internally.
What did the boat mean?
Internally trying to find my way to this tree. The tree was where it was light. It was beautiful, and it seemed everywhere I was going around Ireland, I was seeing this tree. It was mad. It was really, it was a very deep and moving experience in my life. That whole period over maybe 5 or 6 months was because when you go to that kind of therapy, you're tuning into yourself like you never do in any other sense, you know. And it's tiring. It's it's really, it draws a lot out of you, but it draws an awful lot of good out of you as well. And for me,
yeah.
I had all these images that I was creating, and
you mentioned in the book when you were 5, your dad made you a paper plane.
Yeah, yeah, he was great. It was I remember it as one of the best presents I ever got, because I got so much.
Was that a Christmas present?
Yeah, it was my Christmas. That was my under the tree moment, and it was one of these wooden planes that you create. It was like just a propeller and a little wooden shaft in it, and there was a back propeller in it. And it was an elastic band wrapped around the front propeller. So you wound that up. You went upstairs to the top floor and just let it off. And it flew. And the whole idea of it flying was just incredible. It was just great to see something that you made flying around. And then it crashed. And poor dad had to fix it. I don't know how many times he kept fixing it.
But it was a testament to him that he had the patience to do it.
Constantly doing it. He never stopped. He never, until it was like eventually, I think he might have said to me, you know, the game is up.
But because of, I mean, it was because of him that you got into what you ended up doing with your life.
Without a doubt, yeah.
You know, was he running a music hall or?
Yeah, he was collecting tickets. He was what we call in those days, he was a bouncer, but there was never any bouncing. There was two friends of his who were big, burly ex-boxers, and they were the bouncers. And my dad was like the butcher's galley. He was the guy who'd do all the talking at the door and calm people down because he'd never fought anything in his life. He never hit anything in his life. So he was the kind of the talker, and the two boys were kind of his backup. They were his henchmen. So there was never any trouble in dance hall. And
which part of Ireland was this again?
Ennis. He worked in the Jet Club, and he worked in the Jet Club was the big dance hall, but like from the old dance hall days. And so we had all the show bands coming there.
Who did you meet?
The Clipper Carlton, Teddy and the Hilos, and there was all these bands. I remember the names now because I used to collect their photographs. The Miami. I remember meeting Fran O'Toole when he was with the Miami. I've met Butch Moore, Dickie Rock. I met them all. And
is that when you decided this is what I want to do with my life?
I just loved what they were doing. I was in awe of this stage thing. And then we had the Cayley Band in Ennis, and I was the singer in the Cayley Band. I wasn't a great musician. The lads were very proficient in whistles and fiddles and that, but I could barely belt out a tune, but I sang all the songs. I sang Kevin Barry and all those ballads at the function. So I was a singer in the local Cayley Band. And then this was happening every week. We were looking at the bands. And then I discovered the guitar at 12.
Was that your brother's guitar you found?
Yeah, I found my brother. My brother had a gut string guitar that he wasn't.
How would your life have been different if you hadn't found your brother's guitar?
I have no idea. I really have no idea because I don't think I was ever cut out to play the banjo or the fiddle or, you know, I never had the dedication for that. But it was something when I played the guitar, something struck. When I got the guitar in my hand and I got my first couple of chords, I felt, wow, this is it, you know. And even when I look back now, I know that at the time you get frustrated with guitar because you want everything to happen immediately. But even at that stage, I remember. Maybe it was my teacher, that there was a Franciscan priest who taught, and he used to play soccer. He was a lovely man. He taught me, and he taught me patience to kind of work through it and get the guitar. And he gave me my first few lessons. And then I stopped going to him for lessons, and I started working on my own. And I bought a Leonard Cohen book with his chord tablatures in it, and that was me. I bored the country silly with Leonard Cohen songs.
How many years Stockton's Wing was it about 30 years or?
I was with Stockton's Wing for 15 years from.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
From 1980 to 1994. I joined the band in March of 1980, and spent 15 years with them, and several albums. I had been working with Maura O'Connell prior to that. We had a duet called Tumbleweed, and we sang kind of American, new age American country at the time, because Emmylou Harris was just on the scene. Her first album had broke, and we kind of got wind of it, and it was kind of people like Maria Muldaur, and we were getting all this music from a friend of ours called PJ Curtis, who went on to produce so many Irish albums. But he'd been tuned into all this music from abroad and getting albums in. So he turned myself and Maura onto so many great albums, the Abyssinian Baptist Choir.
And the music you were writing, were you aware of that it was coming from a place of pain?
I think I always kind of tuned into some kind of pain or some kind of, I mean, sometimes they used to start telling me my songs were far too serious, you know, because I suppose for years you're kind of looking at, like, I remember somebody gave me a cassette recently of myself and Maura at a gig in, which is 1978, you know, in a folk club. And if the lines and the chorus is, take a walk along Main Street, can you hear the people crying? And it goes on about how, and this is about Ennis Main Street, you know, so. Yeah. So there was a lot of angst. I mean, I laughed.
But you can see why. I mean, I know you're always smiling since I know you. Yeah. But you can see why there was a lot of angst and suffering.
I was,
almost.
But I don't think it's, I don't. You might be right, actually. I never saw it as me trying to figure out what had happened to me. But you actually might be right that was the underlying thing all the time. But I was always trying to find a way out of. I suppose Ennis in a way, and even though I had the most beautiful childhood, but as soon as I hit Doolin when I was 17, I had found a whole, that was my.
Was Doolin sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Yeah, and that was my get out. I was out. That was my gateway, you know, and that was, I mean, I was exposed to people from all over the world. I was exposed to new music. I was exposed to new writing. A Dutch woman gave me a Herman Hesse novel, you know. So I'm reading Narcissus and Goldmund, you know, down on the pier in Doolin. Like 6 or 8 months previous that, I was doing Peg for my Leaving Cert, you know. Yeah. So that was the.
And you were cooking vegetarian food.
Yeah, I was getting into vegetarian food and
lentils. And you cooked for your mum and dad one time, and your dad said he wouldn't give the lentils you cooked to the dog.
That's right. Well, I was brutal cook at the start, but I was determined. And I think it was just me trying to find my own way. And I joke about it now sometimes when I talk about the family that there was 8 of us and all 8 of us trying to be the black sheep. And I guess that's where we were, you know. That we were rare to be very individual and trying to create your own. I was trying to create my own position in the world, you know. I never saw myself as being anything special or anything, but I always felt I needed to write and I needed to explore myself far more than I had been led to do at school. I'd never had much faith in what happened at school. So,
what were you taught to be at school? As little as possible?
As little as possible, yeah. I think for me, as little as possible. I mean, because I was writing at school and it wasn't, they didn't want to know about it, you know, like.
Right. And you were told to do as little as possible, then you were listening to Don't Follow Leaders, Watch Your Parking Meters. That was more of your philosophy.
I think so, yeah. I think in a way, yeah. And when you're listening, and the music you listen to, and then the people you're surrounded with, I mean, there was a guy's youth club in Ennis. So we were listening to I've Been to a Desert with a Horse with No Name, you know, these kind of stuff. It's like, there's Neil Young, like, was in there, Bob Dylan, you know. All these, and because I write, I think even at that stage I was writing so much that time. I was into the lyrics all the time. It was lyrics. So I always wanted to find out what the writer was telling me as opposed to humming along the melody of it. I'd buy albums and if the albums had to have the lyrics on them so that I could understand what was going on here. So I think that's.
And you were spending your weekends in Doolin and you were working in Shannon Airport selling statues to the Yanks.
Yeah. I was in mail order in Shannon Airport.
You were actually rapping. It sounds like a Pat Short sketch. You're actually rapping the whole.
The shillelaghs and all. It was like the duty free shop was huge business in Shannon Airport. Massive. I mean, it was a big superstore, you know, at the time, and it was big business. A lot of American tourists coming through, and they were getting the catalogs. And they were buying from the catalogs. We'd have to pack it and send it off. And then there was a mail order from America where we sent out catalogs and they sent back their orders. And it was a big, big business.
Were you going in from there? I mean, you're having your sex, drug and rock and roll weekends and then going straight into work Monday morning. What was the journey like from Doolin to Shannon? It must have been like.
Because you had to do it. I mean, that was your wages and. And then I hadn't, at that stage, I hadn't enough courage. I hadn't built enough courage to tell my parents I was giving up my grand pensionable secure job because I came from that generation where the grand pensionable secure job was really where it was at.
So you could be still at Shannon Airport now?
I could be. I could be running Shannon Airport. Yeah. I could be running. I could be anywhere. I often think about it. I think you make.
At what point did your father realise that you weren't working at Shannon Airport when he saw you on the Late Late Show at Stockton's Wing or something?
No, I remember I left Shannon to work in the local youth centre. I ran a coffee shop. that this priest who was he was working with the local bishop, but he was in the youth services, amazing guy, and he created one of the first ever drop-in centres in the country, in Ennis, and it was a drop-in centre for students coming back from school in the afternoons. He kind of noticed they were all lighting around town, and he thought, geez, if there's a place to go where they could listen to music and have coffee in it. So he created this thing, and I got the job of running the coffee shop, a friend of mine.
Your guard wasn't up about, given your previous experience?
No, definitely no. No, I trusted him. He's a lovely man.
Yeah.
And he was a great man, and he was a giving man. He gave so much to young people. He was just great. No, I had no fear of him at all.
Yeah.
None.
I mean, as little as I know of you, that's the kind of person that I, whenever I meet you, you always seem kind of very happy and, you know,
I'm happy
warm
now.
And giving, you know. Was it a journey to get to that place?
Yes. It's been.
Does your wife ever wonder that she married one fella and she's got another
now?
Yeah,
she often says it. And
what was it like for her?
I don't know. I think she was searching as well, you know. She was doing her own search. I think that's why we kind of connect with each other. We could never have children, and that was a major event for both of us, and we had to deal with that.
How did you deal with that?
On a very personal level, talk about it and work it through and accept the fact that it would be the two of us living together, looking at each other across the table every morning. And we did it, you know. And so I think both of us are on a very similar journey. I think we're so connected, yet we're so far apart in personalities. But I think that's what keeps us going.
What's her personality like?
Hmm?
What's her personality like?
Very bubbly.
Yeah.
Very bubbly.
But you're hardly a miserable shite, if you don't mind me saying.
No, but I used to be, though. I mean,
really?
I mean, yeah, well, when I used to get when I'd let the world get in top of me, and, you know, when you're busy and all that, it's funny, Donna always says to me that when I started working for Pat Short, like, I ran a kitchen for Pat for 3 years, and I'd known Pat for a long time. And Donna always says that when I started working for Pat, I got my mojo back right there, because Pat's personality and mine are very much alike. I'd lost that personality from business and a sense of depression at different times of my life. That person had left me, and Pat kind of woke it up. You know, he
laughed it out of you.
Yeah, and we had such
a great...
He told
you to climb out of your hole almost.
He actually didn't even tell me. It was just whatever I connected... I connect to Pat like a real friend, in the sense that I connect with his humour, and I connect to his humanity, because he's such a wonderful man. And we kind of trust each other as two pals. And that's kind of started giving me the bubbly personality. And then I'm now in a situation where I have a book written, and I'm thinking, how great is that? I mean, if you told me that 10 years ago, I'd be laughing at you. You know, 15 years ago, I just said, not a chance.
What was it like to write Beautiful Affair?
It was the most amazing gig I've ever been involved in. I think the fact that it was about me, and I don't mean that in a selfish sense. All my life, I've been kind of working with people, always trying to make people around me happy and look after them in the business and that. Always trying to be the pleaser and things like that, and make sure the gig works. And even with Ronnie, I was guitar
player. Did you get lost in all that?
Yeah. In that whole sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I lost... it's grand. When you're working, when you're looking after everyone else, you forget about yourself.
Yeah.
So, and when I got to the book, it was suddenly about me. And it was about me going back over my life and what it meant to me to be a young fella at home, my dad, when he was teaching me all the things he was doing, what it was like to be with mum, how it was like to be with Stockton's Wing as me, the writer, you know, what Doolin did to me, not what Doolin did to the rest of the world. And I had to write from that sense.
What did you think of that Mike Hanrahan?
I really liked him.
Yeah. But prior to that, you probably didn't like him, did you?
I'd completely forgotten about him. You get caught up in business, you know, you get caught up in doing things, and you really get caught up and you forget about who you are or where you came from. And for me, the book gave me that sense to get back into that personality.
Before it's too late.
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky to be able to have gone back into myself and read the stuff I wrote. Whether it was like, as I call it, the deep and meaningless poetry I was writing, it didn't matter. I was writing it for some reasons. It was coming from somewhere inside.
Didn't you also find diaries that you had written?
Yeah, loads of them. And like, I never knew I had so many girlfriends when I was a teenager. It looked like there was girlfriends every week and they were falling in and out of love with me and I was falling in love with them. But that was really...
And were there?
Yeah, because it was a youth club. So, but back in those days, you fall in love with somebody and you might get a peck in the cheek, you know, and then that would be grand. And then she'd find someone else in the nightclub or the youth club next week.
Simpler times.
Yeah, much simpler times.
How did you meet your wife?
She'll kill me now if she'll hear it, so we talk about this on air. I met her, she was on a blind date in Bad Bob's.
Not with you, presumably.
No, at Stockton's Wing. We're doing a gig and a friend of mine came to the gig and his mate was on a blind date with Donna, and that's as far as the date went, really. I met her after the gig and we just...
Why did you start showing rock star shapes or something?
She says I did, yeah.
Did you?
I'm claiming the fifth, no. But I really liked her. I liked the look of her and I liked the way we met when we talked. And then we met the following week by chance in our local pub. And then 3 or 4 days later, we had our first date and that was it. We have not looked back since. We're still holding hands. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the plan for the future? Is there another book? Is there... Are you touring again with Stockton's Wing? Or
it's crazy. I mean, I've been on a kind of a whirlwind trying to tell the world about the book, and it's been really lovely going back to so many beautiful villages and towns around Ireland and talking about it. And I'm kind of tired of talking about myself now, and I'm kind of afraid I'm going to meet myself in some studio or somewhere. So I'm going to chill out for a couple of weeks because January is going to be hectic for Stockton's Wing. Universal Music have just bought the rights to all the entire catalogue of Stockton's Wing. In fact, they've bought the catalogue of the entire collection from Tara Records. And we're the first of their releases. And I've spent the last couple of months with Universal putting together a package of a compilation of 42 tracks and working on an album and a sleeve design. And that's out in the middle of January, and we're back. Stockton's Wing are back, and I'm so delighted about it. It's exciting because it means a whole few generations who had never heard Stockton's Wing are now going to hear our music. Quite a lot of the tracks have some of them have been previously unreleased, some of them have never been released on CD. You know, some of them have been albums that, as I used to say, it wasn't released, it kind of escaped out there.
Or sometimes they weren't released for a reason.
yeah. And there's a couple of mad, there's a great track from written by Shea Healy and produced by Bill Whelan. And it was in the mid-80s, early 80s. And it was called Run for the Gold. And we recorded for the Irish Olympic team who were heading off somewhere for their Olympics. And we were the national song. And I hadn't heard that for donkey's years. So there's a couple of tracks of that that are nice. And that's something to really look forward to. On music is really going to take me over next year.
Is music therapy for you?
Yeah, I'm delighted to be back. I'm thrilled.
But you're back in the right way. You don't want to burn yourself out again,
yeah,
and bring depression into your life.
I tell you, the way I look at it now, Barry, is that I don't want to take over the world anymore in music, which is what you do when you're young fella. You want to take over the world. All I want to do is make the world I live in a nice place to live in and make really nice music and work with really good people. And I want to surround myself with good people. So I don't want all that other frills that we had and that's around it all, the crap that goes around with it, the bullshit that surrounds the music. So you develop a people around you. I have Stockton's Wing. It's a nice lineup. It's a great band. I won't make it my career. It'll be nice for what it is. But I work with Leslie Dowdle and we work together as a duo on stage, and it's the most beautiful gig. You know, we do stuff that's way beyond what we normally do, and we love playing music together. And then I also work with Eleanor Shanley, because we worked with Ronnie together and we started writing a show together remembering Ronnie Drew.
What did you learn about life from Ronnie?
About life, I got to learn a lot. I learned how to be. I learned how to be when I'm older. To be, I really want to be as grumpy and as cranky as he was, because he had a, he was good at it.
But he did it well, yeah, exactly.
He was really good at it.
Yeah,
he had a great sense of humour about it all. You know,
it was almost contained in the cantankerousness.
It really was, and if I can remember, I'll tell you one which really for me sums Ronnie. We were in a hotel one time, and the whole service industry was changing, and. Suddenly went into this hotel and there was nobody serving breakfast. We had to serve ourselves everything. Like, you had to get the sausages, the eggs, the tea, the coffee, the milk, you name it. Even the toast, you had to make your toast in this thing that winds the toast around and it never comes out brown enough. Ronnie had fired in again to get toasted. And every time he'd come back down, he'd forget something. He was getting really, really frustrated with this new system. So, like, and he was fuming. And instead of losing the rag, he went up to the guy who was checking your room numbers. There was one guy on, and his only task was to make sure no one was getting in there eating breakfast for nothing. So he checked, what's your room number, please? So Ronnie went up to him and said, he showed him a tenner, and he says, excuse me, son, he says, is there any chance you'd just change that tenner? Just change it for coins. I just want to give myself a tip. And that was his way of getting his, and I loved that about him. And he taught me that kind of way of looking at things, not to be, he was a very deep soul. Like, he loved literature, he loved Ireland, he loved our history.
A bit like yourself really, isn't he?
I'm growing into the Ronnie that I learned, and I feel I learned so much from him.
Are you being more cantankerous with Donna?
Oh God, no! I wouldn't get away with that at all. Are you joking?
You get the
me?
Breakfast chair tray over your head.
But Donna's lucky. I do all the cooking, so she's happy out there.
You're giving her lentils. She said you wouldn't give that to the dog.
No, she would. Didn't. I don't think the lentils would work. No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't cut the mustard in our house. Not at all.
Mike, listen. Thanks a million for coming in.
Brilliant. Cheers.
Has your fuse box gone haywire? Is your water pressure too weak? Or maybe your boiler needs an upgrade. They don't last forever, you know. Well, the good news is that there's a local hero in Dublin for that. So if a blocked sink is not helping with Wednesday's hump day, take the hassle out of it with localheroes.ie. Our online service connects you with trusted tradespeople in your area, and all work comes with a 12-month guarantee backed by Bord Gáis Energy. Try it out while listening to your podcast. You could get a quote in minutes at localheroes.ie. T&Cs apply. Visit localheroes.ie for full details.